time is almost up. Thanks for listening to Big Band Broadway and Beyond. God bless, and if anybody asks, tell them Joe sent you.
Must we let it end?
This is WHFR Dearborn. It's time now for the new WHFR Journal local news and views. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal local news and views. What matters to you most is happening right next door. So listen up here, folks. Let's dig deeper into the news. My name is Jay Koronik. Happy to be with you today and joined in the studio by our WHFR news director, Dennis Reimar. So, Dennis, how are you?
I am very well. Very well. How are you? How was your trip to the market this morning?
Well, we had a great day. Of course, in great weather, people are thinking about going out and getting some fresh fruit, maybe some new flowers or some plants, herbs, vegetables to plant in the garden now, get a head start in the season. And a lot of people were out there. It was a very exciting time, as well as, of course, the Henry Ford Community College contingent. And talking this morning, we talked about the 21st Century Technical Communication Program. And of course, everything here at the college is 21st century. Why? Because we're in the 21st century. It'd be interesting if they call it the 22nd century program. That would really get a head start on the technology. But
I think that would cause a few people to pause. Yes.
Yeah, who knows what that's going to be if we ever do get there. In any event, yeah, it was a great morning. I always get my it's almost a tradition for me now. There's one vendor that has apple fritters. And they're always delicious. That's one of my favorite little pastries, though I don't eat pastries hardly ever, but I just can't resist one of them. They sell them singly, luckily.
And what is it, an apple fritter a day? There's some kind of a saying.
Yeah. Keep the teacher retired or something.
Yeah.
And there was, a new vendor was Armenian pastries.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, Middle Eastern things somewhat. I mean, they look like baklava type cakes and powdered fig things and so on. And I didn't get a chance to sample any of those.
Oh, but we'll get some next week.
They probably had more cookies and little cakes and pastries this time than any time last year. So I think there a lot of them are hoping for the lunchtime crowd just to buy a cookie or two to go with a sandwich or whatever. And, whatever. We'd like to support that. That is the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market. It is in the Bryant Public Library parking lot, or half of it anyway, which is right next to the Bryant Public Library, which is still a library thanks to the last budget go around.
Wonderful segue.
It'll still be a library. we wanted to move into our first story, which is just a slight follow up. If you want to know, say, well, what about that Dearborn budget that was passed? Weren't you listening last week to the journal? We spent about 50 minutes of the hour going in detail about what was actually passed, and so we're not going to repeat that today. But remember, you can always go to whfr.fm, that is our website on the internet. WHFR.fm. Click on the journal button on that homepage and go to last week's show, which is June the 11th or 10th. Today is June the 17th. And you can listen to it that way and see what we had to say and go over all the details. It is covered in a couple of stories in the Press and Guide and the Times Herald this week. And we always recommend you read very closely either or both of the local Dearborn papers. If you live in Dearborn, that's the only way you can know in detail what's really going on. We try to add a little between the lines or interpretation or history to the stories here on this show, but we can't obviously cover all the details in an hour. So the top story, headline story on the Press and Guide from last Sunday, June 12th, the story on the right, so I'm not sure, the headline goes over both the story on the left and the story on the right. So the one on the right says voters might be asked to okay additional taxes. Well, there's no doubt about that, folks. I mean, there's not enough money. Mayor O'Reilly has said even several times at public meetings earlier this year, as well as the State of the City address, that he is going to propose additional millage, which will probably be on the ballot in November. As we said last week, we just don't know exactly how much that's going to be of additional millage. The budget increased the millage collection up to the maximum of 15 mils, so I think we said on average, the average home in Dearborn will be paying another $80 a year in taxes. But of course, the taxes have been going down for the last several years because of the value of the homes going down. And so we're nowhere near the total dollars of taxes that we paid 4 years ago in Dearborn for the same house. So they're just building back up a little bit in order to keep the city going. Well, so here's the story, though. Even though that word voters might be asked, and it's not definite that they will be, but I could almost guarantee it. I'll bet anybody a penny, okay?
Okay.
But I'll only bet one person because, you know, I don't have that many pennies. But okay, Dennis took me up on it.
That
there will be a million. No, you don't want to lose a penny, Dennis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Okay.
He's a hardworking student here. and helping with the One Act Play Festival.
Oh, boy. But
let me finish the story,
please.
And we'll talk about the One Act Play Festival. On page 11A from last Sunday's paper, it goes over some details. And here's what O'Reilly said, a direct quote from our mayor in Dearborn. He said about the, you know, there was sort of a public outcry, you know, about a dozen people came to the meeting over cuts to quality of life amenities like pools and libraries. And O'Reilly said he now wants to take a broader approach. And he said, quote, I'm beginning to lean more toward a proposal that includes that, meaning public safety, plus other services that people are interested in preserving so that it's less narrow. He said, he went on to say, we know that if we do a police millage, well, probably police and fire together, I would think.
But all that means is earmarking that millage specifically for police and fire, right?
Right. But so, that's what he says, that if we do it just for police or police and fire,
right,
the money we'd have to spend on police anyway will now come from that millage, which will mean that there's more general fund money for other things.
Okay.
So he knew that. But he says the fact that we know that won't necessarily resonate with the voters. Police might say the libraries are still at risk. There's no guarantee the libraries will get their chunk of the general budget anyway,
right.
See? And they might say, or there's no money for recreation. So I'm looking, he says, at something that actually could be a millage that allocates a minimum amount to key items like recreation or those kinds of things. I guess they could, I mean, it all depends how well they want to write it. I certainly guess that they could they could write it, I'm just thinking out loud here, silently in my own brain. They could write one big millage that identifies a set allotment of money for police, for fire, and then for libraries, and then for, and all in the same yes or no vote. So you could technically earmark. You know, you'd have one millage number, but the specific amounts for police, fire, library, whatever they think, pools, that it would be broken down and guaranteed that each of those would go. That might be more interesting to do than having four or five separate millages on the ballot, asking people to vote up or down libraries, up or down pools, up or down. You know, I think that might doom some of the propositions. Of course, they can just say, give us 3.5% more for the city as a whole.
Right.
But some people are very nervous now. Like apparently the voters at Dearborn Heights were a few years ago when they specifically voted a millage for the libraries. So their libraries have guaranteed funding now because of that specific earmarked millage over there. So the library advocates, local activists, they are quite happy that that makes that secure. People of Dearborn, I think, are quite secure in that right now they have in the city charter a guaranteed minimum staffing principle for right. the police and fire. The only trouble is they don't have guaranteed money for it.
Well, with the Dearborn Heights, that they were sweating it out at the time of the vote, though. I mean, they realized the risk they were taking,
Somehow the argument was made successfully with the majority of people who happened to vote. And, of course, that's always a sad story, is that the majority of people don't usually vote. And even if they do, it's the majority of those people voting that passes the ballot proposal or elects the president. And they're not even anywhere close to a majority of the people in society that should be voting.
No, it's so not representative.
That's another problem.
Right.
So those that take the effort to vote, not usually even a majority, but a majority of them or a very definite minority of the group as a whole actually makes the decisions for the rest of us. And I hope you're part of the voters, of course, folks. Anybody listening, you need to register. You need to vote. Of course, in some areas, not in Dearborn, I understand, but there will be a primary election for some local candidates in August. And I think it's August 2nd, a Tuesday, it should be.
Okay.
Yeah. But I don't think there's a primary. I talked with Ned Apigian here on his forum show a couple of weeks ago, Kathy Buda, and I think she indicated there's no primary in Dearborn this August. There will be one in November, and it'll probably have that in there. I just thought it was interesting to see that the mayor thinks he wants to take a broader approach on that millage proposal now, but he also wants to, somehow give the special interest in Dearborn for city services the chance to feel secure too, if of course their proposal passes. So that has to be decided in the next month, folks. They've got to get that on the ballot, as we indicated last week, before the end of July. And so there's no more than 3 weeks before the council definitely has to decide on that ballot proposal, whatever it's going to be, a millage increase, in order to get us through the next 2 years. The mayor is looking not just for the budget that was passed, but 2 more years down the road. And without that extra money, we can't make it. We can't cut enough. I mean, you have to cut all the libraries and cut all the services. No more street sweeping or cleaning. I know most people in Dearborn don't want that. They want to preserve a good portion, certainly, of the services we have now.
So the bottom line isn't so much obviously we'll have to decide where the money goes, but we do know there will be an increase, and we do know that it's necessary.
Yeah,
and I think
absolutely.
People are looking at that intelligently.
I pointed out last week, too, is that of the people who usually vote, more people who are making a secure living, who are rich, vote than the people who are at the poverty level. So that's not representative. But I hope the people who do vote, who happen to have a secure income, whether they call themselves rich or not, want to support that.
Right.
Again, it's just barely recapping some of the savings they've had on their home taxes from the last from 4 years ago. So we've been getting a discount, a lower taxes for 4 years, whether or not we knew it or not. And this just builds it back up a little bit for the sake of saving our city services. So that's great. Now, I haven't covered before, we haven't had a chance to mention that there was a court ruling, a jury verdict against Mark Summers, that's 19th District Chief Judge Mark Summers, and it was about whether or not he had the right as the chief judge to end the service and the position of a person in the court offices. Okay, it was a court probation officer. And it's a question of definition whether or not this person was in a just cause or an at-will job situation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at-will means, well, you can be dismissed anytime the person in charge says, we don't need you anymore.
Right.
And if it was just cause, as the court said, as this last court ruling said, then this person was unfairly dismissed. And the ruling right now says that the court, that is the city of Dearborn, has to pay $464,000, almost $500,000, in past and future damages because this person won't have their job. So it's past salaries a couple of years.
Right.
This happened a couple of years ago, and future potential earnings. Oh, my gosh. Well, Summers, here's the update on that now, is thinking of challenging the jury verdict, in other words, appealing the case. He plans to do it, it says. Okay. The unfortunate part here, folks, is that there's also another case where he dismissed an employee at the court, saying they were at will, trying to save the court money, of course. That was what he stated were the reasons for both positions being eliminated. They're going to have to save more money because now the district court budget has been cut even more in this latest budget.
So, right.
But it doesn't mean he can fire people until they figure out who's at will and who's just cause now. He claims they're all at will, and other people, like the other district judge, William Hulgren, says, no, no, they're just cause. You have to show cause before you dismiss them. In other words, they're not doing the job in a competent way, or their job could be done. You have to rationally present an argument rather than just saying, we don't need you anymore.
Sure.
The trouble is that he and Hulgren have had bad blood, whatever you want to call it, between them.
Sure.
And the case that's coming up, the person that he dismissed is Hulgren's former girlfriend, who is now, it states in the paper, his fiance. Isn't that nice?
Congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. Well, they've been, apparently, and no disrespect here, they've been living together for years.
Okay.
So it's about time, somebody would say. But they're not married yet. But that doesn't matter. You know, go beyond that. It's just that because it happened to be someone he was very closely involved with, that just added his animosity on various issues like this one,
sure,
to Summers. And in fact, as we know, some of the money to start and pay the lawyers for these lawsuits came from, it was reported in the paper, it came from Hulgren. And I don't know if it was this first one, but definitely the one for his friend, he put money to get that started because it was his friend, and you know, but so he's got money involved in the outcome here,
right?
One way or the other, and that's unfortunate that there's that personal sort of, and I won't say it's a feud, but you know, disrespect between the two at
a
least.
A conflict, a disagreement,
personal conflicts.
Sure, I like that.
Yeah. Summers has been known as a very, in his personal life, and in some of his court decisions, as making very moral rulings. In
sure.
other words, having like high ethical standards that may not even be representative of morality today, but maybe morality in the last generation or something. Now, a lot of people like that, you know, give me that old-time religion. But some people have criticized him is that his rulings have been too strict because of that, and that he dismissed Hulgren's girlfriend, now fiancé, for moral reasons. That we don't want you around if you're living with somebody but not married to them. You know, that's all speculation. It's never been directly reported, but people draw these conclusions, not even myself here, because but other people that know them because of that. No, so I'm not against that at all. I think all employees should be just cause.
But
personally,
in Michigan, unless you're in a union, aren't most employees at will?
Yes, exactly, especially in private businesses.
Well, this isn't private, but yeah, no, I know
right,
what you're
this
saying.
Is public,
and that may be where uh-huh. the line is.
Yeah,
whether
so. I mean, that's what the if it does go to the next court, that's what they have to decide. Notice that this last one was a jury trial. And all due respect to juries, and I've just been on one briefly,
briefly.
Yeah, a couple months ago, thank goodness it was brief. It was a mistrial, so we all had to be dismissed before it finished. But juries are not lawyers. You know, they're average people. You sure. want a jury of your peers. But the judge tries to tell you, give you instructions before you make your final ruling, what the laws really are.
Right.
And how to figure it out. And so the big problem I see with our jury system is that if you have a jury, the jury doesn't necessarily know law as well as the judge or either lawyer, and therefore they're not necessarily going to have an interpretation that fits the law exactly, which is why we have appeals possible.
Sure.
If the jury didn't really consider this or that fact that is important, first of all, the judge of that case could set aside the ruling, say, well, that's just crazy. He didn't say crazy to the jury, but he says, I have to set that aside. You obviously didn't look at the major point of law that I told you about,
right,
in coming to your acquittal or guilty verdict or whatever. But they don't usually set that aside. Actually, the set aside thing, as it says in the story here, Summers has already filed for the judgment to be reassessed. And he said he wants the verdict to be set aside. He says it's an oft-requested but infrequently granted motion where a trial judge can exercise discretion to avoid extreme or unreasonable jury decisions.
Hmm.
I think $500,000 hitting the city of Dearborn, that's kind of, you know, an extreme decision.
Well, you wonder how much you made, you know?
Well,
and no wonder they got engaged.
Maybe for, I mean, I could understand for the last couple of years while the case is being heard that they reinstate her pay for this person, I think it was a she,
yeah.
Simone. But future earnings, can't this person get a job somewhere else? If the city really doesn't need that extra probation officer.
What you're saying is that's not necessarily a negative. It's not a negative recommendation or something, a reference. You're just saying, hey, there's no more job.
Right.
So how should that affect somebody's ability to get another one?
Right.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with this. But if they don't set aside the ruling or reduce the amount of the fine or the verdict, the money tied to the verdict, then we'll see where it goes, whether or not it goes up to the next level, where there might not be another jury hearing. It could just be the judge himself.
Sure.
Sometimes they have three judges mm-hmm. overseeing things, and they decide among themselves afterwards.
Deliberate among themselves.
So I just want to mention the city of Dearborn is sitting there with that $500,000 ruling. By the way, I hate to go back in the far distant past, but Hulcrum used to be the city attorney, and he lost. I mean, I say he lost because he was the lead attorney for the city. I think, and I'm trying to remember exactly, it was at least two or three, if not four or five, major cases, each of which was hundreds of thousands of dollars each. Now, maybe the city was just in the wrong, but he took it all the way to the end, and we probably lost, if it was four or five, at $200,000 or more. It was against the police department. It was against other. And I personally feel, and this is the opinions on this show are not necessarily those of anyone else, certainly not anyone else at Henry Ford Community College, that he was moved into the district courts because he had lost so many cases. Whether or not he was incompetent as the city attorney, he did lose a whole bunch of cases that set the city back millions of dollars, okay? And I think tens of millions, in fact. But anyway, whatever it was, the way our system is, you promote people up to a level where they can't do much harm anymore.
Right.
That's called the Peter Principle from years ago in business. Is that? But of course, then you have only semi-competent people at that higher level.
Yeah.
By people that know enough to do an adequate job, but they're not brilliant, and therefore, this was a criticism, I think 20, 30 years ago that book was written called The Peter Principle, is that the problem with business is you have people promoted up because they did a great job. But then at the next level up, they're not quite able to be brilliant anymore.
But
they stay there not being brilliant, and that hurts the whole business.
But you're not saying Hulgren had anything negative since he's been in district court, though.
No, he has.
He seems like he's
no one has made a criticism of his rulings or his judgments. One criteria would be how many appeals do people win.
I think that's the main criteria.
Summers claims, without talking about Hulgren, that he has a very, very low rate of appeals that
he
have
turned
over his rulings.
Yeah.
So that, in other words, he has followed the letter of the law to a great extent, but I don't know what, you know, Hulcrum's numbers are. That's one way to look at the success of the judge.
Sure.
How many appeals, that is reversals, have been won against you. That might say how well you're you know, adjudication is going.
So you're saying that this the young lady in question, Simone, is the was a live-in girlfriend?
No. Simone is the probationary officer that was also dismissed without just cause. That was the case that was just ruled
gotcha.
On.
Gotcha. Okay.
The live-in friend, the fiance now of Hultgren, that case is coming up next.
Gotcha.
I don't know how quickly. But,
no. Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't like Hultgren asked her to marry him because she won.
Not in this
400.
Case.
Okay.
No, not in this case. But that could be a similar type of ruling.
You never
of course.
Know.
You never know what they want to do or what they're asking for.
Right.
I should mention also that Summers, we didn't cover this before, was the one that a couple of weeks ago ruled that the Michigan medical marijuana law passed into law by the voters of Michigan in a ballot about 2 or 3 years ago
right.
was unconstitutional. I mean, he said that. A district court judge said that. Now, that's got to go up. It's being appealed now. It looks like he's going to be reversed on that. I heard on the Craig Folly show on WDET, a couple of law professors at Wayne State said, that's just crazy. You know, it's true the federal government does say you can't grow, sell, or distribute marijuana. They've got that law on the books.
Right.
And I've got a commentary about that that maybe we can look at today even, about the war on drugs.
Sure, sure.
Okay, a little later. But Summers was involved there. I mean, he got big press about that. Of course, the city of Dearborn has been saying, we're going to say where, and maybe even how many, these medical marijuana distributing businesses
dispensaries
can be put in Dearborn.
Sure.
And some of the people on the council, we don't want any of them in Dearborn.
Right, right. And I've heard that often.
As if unsavory people are lingering around the medical marijuana dispensaries.
You may not know this answer to this, but is it treated in a similar way that, to get a liquor license? Do you know? Do you go there?
There's a licensing procedure before you can open the business. Now,
sure.
Supposedly, though, what you need and what you need to do responsibly is to look at the validity of the prescription you get, because you can only get the marijuana from those licensed facilities with a prescription from a doctor that says, you know, it's going to help you with glaucoma or, relieving the pain of a cancer treatment. So, and there's a couple of other, you know, verifiable positive uses for medical marijuana.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean the people that are using it are using it in the prescribed manner. In other words,
unfortunately, you'll see it in the Metro Times every week and at the back of Detroit.
$100. You get a card.
Like the doctor has got a table next to the office, the dispensary, and he'll just write it out for anybody.
Jay, they set up shop at the Novi Hilton.
Yeah.
I mean, they go out
really.
Where they come in and they can sign them up for these cards in mass. Yeah.
And
crazy.
One use for medical marijuana could be for extreme anxiety.
Sure.
Well, you know, many of us are anxious a lot every day under stress and that. And, oh, my God. So if that's all it takes, an unscrupulous doctor who's getting paid
sure.
a fee, of course, to write that prescription, that they could just start writing prescriptions right and left for just anybody. And that would promote maybe more use of marijuana, which may or may not be a problem in our society that already overdoes alcohol.
Sure.
That's a major health problem, but it's still legal, which just boggles my mind. But we went through that prohibition thing, and that didn't work in the 20s. So, well, I wasn't there. But
oh, you just ruined my joke.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so I just want to mention those two things about Summers. Let's listen to a couple comments right now from Jim Hightower. The first one is about Big Coal buying fourth graders. Okay, the people are doing the strip minings and having the deep mines that keep collapsing on the workers. It looks like they've done a PR thing here to get fourth graders on their side. That doesn't seem fair. Also his comment about privatization, which a lot of Republicans especially think is a great thing, is the road to hell. Can we say that on the air? Yes, we can.
Yes.
Okay, it's a metaphor, folks. Okay, so listen to Hightower. These are very interesting commentaries, and we'll wake you up a little bit, and we'll be back with more of the new WHFR Journal here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
If some predator was stalking fourth graders in your community, there'd be a mighty uproar to make the predator get away and stay away from your schools. But what if the stalker is the coal industry, dressed in an academic outfit in a gambit to brainwash fourth grade school kids? Unbeknownst to most Americans, grade schoolers are being targeted by the American Coal Foundation with a propaganda package stealthily titled, The United States of Energy. It's not mentioned in the materials, but Big Cole paid big bucks to Scholastic Inc. to develop the shamelessly distorted promotion of the dirtiest fuel on Earth. The package fills little minds with the joys of having 600 friendly coal-fueled utilities generating electricity 24 hours a day. Not a peep is made about the toxic waste, air and water pollution, mine explosions, black lung deaths, mountaintop destruction, greenhouse gas emissions, political corruption, and other decidedly unfriendly aspects of what industry propagandists simply tout as black gold. This educational package has been distributed to 150,000 fourth grade teachers, potentially putting its perverted view into the heads of more than a million children. Of course, the coal giants could not have entered so many schools on their own, so they bought access to our kids through Scholastic, a $2 billion a year corporation that places its materials in 90% of U.S. classrooms. Indeed, Scholastic's in-school marketing division brags of its ability to, quote, promote client objectives by targeting teachers and students with classroom packages that, quote, make a difference by influencing attitudes and behavior. This is Jim Hightower saying, how sweet. To help stop this kind of predatory marketing, contact the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, commercialfreechildhood.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
A recent article in The Onion, the satirical newsweekly, disclosed that President Obama had come up with a surefire plan to balance the federal budget. Rob Fort Knox. I've got the blueprints, Obama is quoted as saying, and I think I found a way out through a drainage pipe. Unfortunately, with today's political climate dominated by howling winds from the far-right fringe, there's no longer any room in American culture for satire. Sure enough, some laissez-faire extremists at such Koch-funded corporate fronts as Cato Institute and Heritage Foundation are presently howling for the government to sell all of America's gold stored in Fort Knox. Noting that gold is going for nearly $1,500 an ounce and that we have millions of ounces in the vaults, a fellow from Heritage made this keen observation. It's just sort of sitting there. Yeah, Professor, like Mount Rushmore, the Grand Canyon, the Lincoln Memorial, and other national assets, being there is the point. Yet, these ivory tower ideologues are using the current brouhaha over the budget deficit as an opening to push their loopiest fantasies of selling off all of America's public properties, facilities, systems, and treasures to create a no-government plutocratic paradise. Just spread our public goods out on tables like a flea market from hell and invite the global rich to buy it all. For example, the government could raise billions of dollars to retire that pesky deficit simply by selling our interstate highway system, says another Koch-funded fellow. Americans would then have to pay tolls forever to the corporate owners, but hey, he exclaims, remember that tolls, quote, work for the river Styx, why not the beltway? This is Jim Hightower saying, what a perfect metaphor for privatization. According to ancient mythology, dead souls must pay a toll to be ferried across the river Styx and enter the depths of hell.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
This is the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area, coming to you from Henry Ford Community College. And this is Jay Kornick, and Dennis Reimars is in the studio with me. We wanted to go next to a story not directly in the local papers here. We do want to mention, of course, before the end of the hour, more details about the Arab International Festival starting today right here in the Dearborn area, although a little bit west, the Belleville National Strawberry Festival.
Wow.
National strawberries are going to be there. Huh. That's also today through the 19th. And the Cares Festival, which is going to be next weekend that we've already talked about. And the fact that Dearborn is laying off 50 teachers.
Wow.
50 more teachers, more go each year, and there's some twists and turns on that. Maybe it won't be 50, but we want to mention some details on that. Let me follow up here, this national report from the Libertarian Party. That's right, the third largest political party in America, usually on the ballot in all 50 states during the the presidential elections and having a slate of candidates all the way down to the local level, usually. They sent an email today indicating that it's the 40th anniversary today, June 17th, 2011, 40 years ago, President Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs, which has become a relentless violation, they say, of the lives and property of Americans, including many who have never taken illegal drugs. These violations continue under President Barack Obama, an admitted former cocaine user who has shown no hesitation in throwing people into prison, a punishment he might have suffered had he been caught, they say. Moreover, although promising to respect medical marijuana use in states where voters have approved it, the Obama administration, that's the other segue, Dennis, you see, medical marijuana.
Okay. Very nice.
Okay. The Obama administration has already conducted close to 100 raids on patients, growers, and compassion centers in those states. America's first experiment in prohibition involved alcohol, which I've just mentioned too, and is widely recognized as a failure. It was approved, go back now, remember your history, in 1919, Prohibition 1, libertarians call it Prohibition 1, led to a steady rise in both alcohol usage and violent crime. The murder rate rose 50% between 1919 and 1933, peaking at 9.7 murders per 100,000 population in 1933, when the country finally decided enough was enough, because it fostered, if anybody looks at history, it fostered criminal behavior to keep producing the alcohol and paying, bribing people to allow it to be served and distributed. And of course, then there was gang wars from one gang to another for the tremendous profits they could get from something that's illegal.
The fastest way to increase revenue in an industry is to make it illegal.
Well, that's the generalization libertarians would agree with, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, but so wait a minute. You said something. Forget it. It'll come to me.
Okay. Sorry. Well, anyway, as soon as it was eliminated, gangsterism went into a swift decline after 1933. That's the historic fact. With all the major gangs disappearing within 18 months. And the murder rate dropping every single year for more than a decade. Now, what they call Prohibition 2, the war on drugs, mm-hmm. starting in 1971, has been another tragedy. And Libertarian Party says, we applaud the efforts of law enforcement against Prohibition, which is LEAP, an organization of current and former police, prosecutors, judges, DEA agents, Drug Enforcement agents, and others, which issued a 20-page report just this month detailing the tragic results of this misguided crusade entitled Ending the Drug War, A Dream Deferred. In their report, again according to the Libertarian Party, LEAP documented some of the measurable costs: over 1 million people arrested each year, $1 trillion spent, and drug gangsterism at a level that dwarfs its alcohol equivalent, and which has led to a bloodbath in Mexico that is spilling over into the United States. Not because of drugs, but because of drug laws, they say. And over 120 million Americans have used illicit drugs. Only the most deluded observer believes that the laws have curbed drug abuse, and only the cruelest believes that 40% of the American population belongs in prison. No wonder 67% of police chiefs say the war on drugs is a failure. And of course, the political party points out also the Libertarian Party points out that in Portugal, they moved to decriminalize all drug use. So it's still regulated. This is what marijuana supporters would like to see done, for more than just medical purposes.
Sure.
Not legalize it, but you decriminalize it, which means people could grow their own. But you can't do massive commercial advertising or distribution.
That was my question. You just brought it. You just triggered that. During Prohibition, wasn't there an aspect of drinking that was legal? In other words, you couldn't manufacture it, but couldn't you drink it?
Or you could make it at home, I think. I think you could, in long as it wasn't more than a couple gallons. So home stills were popular.
Right.
Trouble with that is, if you did it wrong, you could die.
Right.
In other words,
and there was no money in it, which is what the gangsters all realized, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is the law in Canada regarding marijuana? Is it decriminalized or is it legal?
No, I think they, especially with the Harper administration, it is as illegal as it is here.
Okay.
The only two countries I can remember is the Netherlands. Amsterdam is famous for decriminalized drug use, and Portugal.
Right.
But this happened 10 years ago, and a Cato report, which is the think tank for the libertarians, which is, of course, biased to libertarian points of view.
Sure.
But the think tank called the Cato Institute has looked at the last 10 years in Portugal with decriminalized drug use, and they indicate that drug use has dropped over the first several years, and the Portuguese now use marijuana at lower levels than Americans even use cocaine. So if you take the glamour out of it and the illegal marketing and distribution to young kids and, you know, all kinds of the poor people especially, people can make a choice not to use it.
Sure, and it's not like they have the addicting things in there like tobacco, like a cigarette, so it should be easier to say no.
And decriminalization will still allow medical professionals to help counsel and advise on these things, too. Again, Libertarian Party, third largest political party, and we're not supporting necessarily their view to you, but take a look at it. It's right in their platform here, personal liberty. Individuals should be free to make choices for themselves and to accept responsibility for the consequences of the choices they make. No individual group or government may initiate force against any other individual group or government. And their party's support of an individual's right to make choices in life does not mean that we necessarily approve or disapprove of those choices. And, of course, in the political party debates, Ron Paul, who has been a Republican since the late 90s and been elected to Congress from his district in Texas consistently, was formerly a Libertarian candidate for president. I think it was 92, somewhere around there, and did not win, of course. But he is still espousing primarily Libertarian points of view on things. So I'm going to mention briefly the New York Times. This is their editorial, and it's kind of humorous. They're pointing out what they see as lapses of judgment and factual inaccuracies from all the GOP presidential candidates that are in the race right now and that were on that debate, I think it was Tuesday night. So from Wednesday, June 15th, here's the main editorial from the New York Times. Monday's Republican presidential debate in New Hampshire, full of historical error, economic obfuscation, avoidance of hard truths, and even outright bigotry, was a feast for connoisseurs of dysfunction. A lot of big words there, folks.
Wow.
For radio. Anyway. Desperate to avoid being outflanked on the right, the seven candidates tried so hard to outdo each other in finding fault with President Obama that they seemed to forget that they are competing for the same party nomination. By the end, they had melted into an indistinguishable mass of privatizing, tax-cutting opponents of Sharia law. For now, the candidates are appealing to a Republican Party whose core is so contorted and infuriated Obama that it barely resembles the one that nominated George W. Bush in 2000. Bush may have prosecuted the war on terror to excess, but he always reminded the country that he was not at war with Islam. This batch of Republicans has dispensed with such niceties. Herman Cain repeated his statement that he would not be comfortable with a Muslim in his cabinet. Some, he said, quote, are trying to kill us, unquote. None of the other candidates took him to task for this. Mitt Romney, a Mormon who has been the subject of religious slurs, mentioned the nation's founding principle of religious tolerance and respect, but missed a chance to include Muslims. Newt Gingrich tumbled over the historical cliff, announcing some kind of loyalty oath to serve in his administration, similar to that used in dealing with Nazis and communists. At least no one brandished a list of known Muslims serving in Obama's State Department, which is what Joseph McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, did in the 50s, and he was, I have to say, an extremist, if not obviously mentally disturbed over that issue, and criminalizing people. I mean, defaming them with no right for them to appeal his statement about what they were or how much they were doing bad things for the country. A dark time in the mid-50s with the McCarthy hearings. Just say, well, they said they like unions, so they must be a communist, so they should be fired. And because of the pressure of his bully pulpit as a senator of the U.S., that happened. And people couldn't appeal it. They couldn't go to court. Well, your employer just doesn't want you, that sort of at-will thing. And so New York Times concludes, eventually the winner of the Republican nomination will move away from the Tea Party's anger to try to appeal to a broader electorate that has higher priorities. That electorate, eager to hear the candidates' plans to resuscitate the economy, would be hard-pressed to find a coherent pathway out of joblessness from the Republican field on Monday. Asked how he would start to put the 14 million jobless back to work, Rick Santorum said that he would repeal health care reform and drill for oil. Tim Pawlenty was one of several making the empty argument that more tax cutting would, quote, get the economy moving, unquote. Santorum actually vowed to let the, quote, the wealth really trickle down. He's going to let that happen.
I'm happy.
Yeah, I bet the wealthy are going to let it trickle down. I don't see that happening. Michelle Bachmann had the strangest, most simplistic economic solution of all, according to the New York Times. She said, simply close down the Environmental Protection Agency, which she said, quote, should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Hmm.
Right, as if we have no pollution in this country anywhere from coal, from oil, from nuclear that needs to be taken care of, that nobody is taking care of locally. Talk about job creation. Let's take care of that pollution. We're going to have a ton of jobs. I think the EPA, if it was really doing its job, would have tens of thousands of jobs created to help us clean up what business and industry has already dirtied and is not taking the initiative to clean up on their own.
And then after cleaning up, they can start enforcing those laws, so it's not just a slap on the wrist anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for free markets, but it's been proven over time that capitalism unfettered? Okay, however, whatever
left
that word
alone,
is,
right?
Left alone is going to go out of control and hurt all of us.
It's like anything, though.
The greed motive, the profit motive will bring us all down. You say, well, the markets will control them. Absolutely not. It's been shown in several cases today that because we have these oligarchies, that is, three or four businesses that control the market, they sort of protect each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they can actually raise prices, like the big oil companies, for example.
Sure.
They can raise prices on things that are not scarce right now just to make more profit. Because people need it, they will keep buying it.
And because it's collusion, they're all doing it.
And they're all doing it.
So everybody, they have to make sure that they're willing to stay in their little piece of the pie. But in general, that's a pretty good piece.
Right. Right. So, I mean, you would think that if gas prices go up, that the individual companies would lower their price. I mean, if oil prices go up, you know, from the Middle East or from Colombia, mm-hmm. or from the tar sands in Canada, if those prices go up, at the pump, you would expect people to cut back their use of gas a little bit. And they have. They've, mm-hmm. I just can't afford that much gas. I'm going to get half a tank today instead of a full tank. But to make up for any losses that would be, the oil companies here in the U.S. have decided to raise the price. Okay.
It's counterintuitive, really.
Yeah. But they want to keep you addicted to your use of oil.
Well,
so that they got their market there in the future. As more and more people buy more fuel-efficient cars or electric cars or plug-in hybrids, they're going to be, again, they'll assume that a certain amount of people have to have the gas, and so they can keep raising prices almost forever until they go out of business. But that's just wrong. Okay, Romney, finishing up the New York Times article here, their editorial opinion on the Republican debate. They say Romney, the presumed frontrunner, provided almost no details of his economic plan except to attack Obama for making the recession worse and longer, quote unquote. He didn't mention that the recession technically ended in June 2009. The field was silent on so many things: how to cover those without health insurance, how to improve education while slashing budgets, which popular programs to cut after the onslaught of tax reductions. It is much easier, apparently, to impress Republican voters with the facile argument that Obama has failed. At some point, voters are going to want these candidates to start making distinctions among themselves, and that will require far more truth-telling than was evident on Monday. Yeah, John King, and he's a host of a show, is it CNBC or it's a CNN or something? He's got a regular weekly show. He was the host of that, sort of a peripatetic, wandering host, talking to all of the Republican candidates, and he showed on the screen that people were emailing questions about those same things, about the big issues, but he wasn't asking them. He just said, look, people are asking those questions, and then he didn't ask them. I'm like, what the heck? You know, and then he asked questions like, what would you prefer? What was it? Like, oh, flat pizza or pan pizza?
He asked that?
Yeah.
Okay, I missed that.
That was, we got to find out your personal preferences here. What does that have to do with being a president?
No.
You can eat any pizza you want.
That's
I don't care, as long as you're a good president, representing and fulfilling the needs of all of us in this country.
Was that like some kind of comic relief or something? Or
probably. What do they call it? A quickie answer period, shotgun questions.
I don't care what kind of pizza until they're elected, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like pan pizza. Vote for me. What the heck?
Well,
okay. All right. Well, we're going to move on, and we're going to talk about the Arab Festival, Dennis.
This is the 16th annual Arab International Festival, starting today, as you said, June 17th through the 19th. It's on Warren Avenue in Dearborn. It's amazing. You know, I was looking through some of the things that are going on here. Yeah. In fact, you did the festival boasts a great number of amusements, live local and international music act, thrilling carnival rides, a huge fun-filled children's tent. Some of the things that I saw here, a lot of magicians. Is that something in the past? Because
well,
I don't remember.
We've had
that.
Magicians at the Dearborn Homecoming, but yeah, it's an awful lot of magicians.
A lot, yeah. But, you know, this game, what we have here is the Press and Guides guide.
Special to, insert.
Yeah, so take get a look at this, and of course, there's Henry Ford sponsoring this.
Yeah, there's times and dates for each of the individual performers there. And I'm not familiar with Middle Eastern celebrities or you know music performers or whatever. They don't seem to have a lot of the big names they had in the past because... cost them a lot of money. They don't have quite all the sponsors. They have a lot of sponsors. I mean, there's a
list
there.
Know they were going to have this until a couple of weeks ago. But, like, for example, not just Middle Eastern, but they have the Arden Academy of Irish Dance will perform. And that's actually today, 7:30 tonight. So, yeah, get a hold of this. It's an insert in the Press and Guide.
Yeah, it looks like it doesn't officially begin, although probably food sales are going on starting now.
That's good with me.
But the entertainment doesn't start until a little bit later. Most people go there to sample the food.
Absolutely.
About 300,000 people, they claim, are there over the 3 days. It's an international fest. In other words, it draws people from all over, and there's a lot of amusement park rides for the kids, and it's all set up right on Warren Avenue, so that Warren Avenue is closed on the east side of Dearborn there for a block or two at least.
Thanks
to the Wayne County Sheriff's Department handling the that closing.
And then they have the second annual International Idol Talent Show competition. So that's
international, something. Not just American Idol.
No. And that's going to showcase the best of the best talent right out of our local high schools. So that's the international is probably the actual acts are international, not necessarily the
What we need is to discover the next Michael Jackson. That's sort of what they referred to
you
there.
Did,
you, crazy.
Okay, I knew you read this. They said there are dancers as good as Michael Jackson.
Yeah, well,
you can interpret that a lot of different ways.
Yeah, but anyway. It's usually a great family thing, and it does showcase, since the businesses of Warren Avenue are still open, too, along the street, that is the merchants there, people also do some shopping in those stores, as well as at the vendors that have the tents on the street and the amusements. So a lot of fun can be had by all.
It is fun. And you know what? And I didn't go last year, but the food was always the big, and the smells because of all the food going on. And it's an exciting time. Then, of course, we have go ahead. You want to cover that?
Dearborn Cares Festival. And Cares, that's our acronym standing for Community Action for a Renewed Environment and Sustainability. That's right. We've got to get it green and keep it green.
That's right.
Again, just a get-together. There is that theme going on, of course, but looks like it'd be a fun time for families. That's not this weekend. It's next weekend, Friday through Sunday, June 24th through 26th. Right. It's at Crowley Park, just off Oxford Street, west of Telegraph.
Right.
South Telegraph, technically. Is it south after... south of? If it's south of Ford Road, I think, or is it south of Michigan Avenue, it becomes south. Well, anyway, it's... South of Michigan Avenue,
right.
And they call it South Telegraph. So a couple blocks down Oxford Street.
Yeah, Oxford Lanes, Bowling Alley's there.
Go west.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And that starts at 6 p.m. on Friday the 24th. There's so much stuff going on. They have a movie. The movie's going to be called No Impact Man, a family adventure film.
Friday night, the 24th.
And that's about a family adventure film about living without waste.
And pretty much all these things are going to be free. The Crowley Park Campout, we know, is $50. They want you to register in advance, but that's well worth it because of the food they provide for the whole weekend. Imagine your whole family living outside. That's an experience.
Yeah, it's going to be an Amish again. Again,
yeah.
Like I was ever.
Music, talent shows, 5K, run, walk, swimming. I guess Crowley Park has a pool.
It does. And I guess it's still open. And the bike parade. Don't forget that.
Mm-hmm.
Bring the bikes.
That's probably little kid strikes, but you can have any bike you want, I guess. So
open mic.
Picnics, games, all kinds of stuff. So you're going to check that out with your family at least one day next weekend, by all means, if you don't decide to camp out. First time they've tried this and need to support that. I've said, and I don't think it's going to be quite as informational an experience, but at least it's a get-together with the idea of the common cause of going green and staying green. And there will be a few booths from nonprofits that relate to that, like Sierra Club. But
the people involved in this, like Mary Ann and Jenny Dunn, who we had a chance to speak with
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago at the farmer market, they're full of knowledge as well. So it will be informational if you search out the certain people. And then while we're on the subject of festivals, I just want to round that out with today is the opening night of the One Act Festival 2011. And that, of course, we've talked on the Campus Connection. We had two of the directors, as well as you and I did last week. And it's a series of five plays, a roller coaster of comedy and drama. Begins tonight. Doors are at 7:30 right here in the Adra Auditorium in the McKenzie Fine Arts Building.
Main Campus, HFCC.
And it's 8 today, 8 tomorrow night, 2 o'clock on Sunday. And we'll repeat the same schedule the next weekend.
And each performance has five plays.
Every performance is exactly right.
Five plays, so you're not missing anything, and it's not just one or two longer. Some of the plays are, what, 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
The shortest one is between 15 and 20 minutes, and the longest one's about 40.
Right.
So you have about 2 to 2.5 hours for $6, Jay.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And, of course,
live theater. What a special thing to do for your father. And you might say, well, I've never gone to a play in my life.
Point.
Well, take him to a play before he dies. I mean, what the heck? I mean, we're all going to go sometime. But
I would want my kids to,
really
but
special.
I'm helping, so
yeah. And, of course, you've been involved with these plays, so the themes of the plays differ. Some are more dramatic, and some are more comedic, probably.
Absolutely.
Probably some things that relate to current social issues or ongoing social issues, like the conflict between men and women and so on.
There's no conflict between. I'm just kidding.
No?
But you know what? And they're very minimal. Do you know theater? So when the setting and the scenery is very minimal, you'll understand that a lot of things are representative of other things. For instance, the car we have is not a real front seat of a car.
When I studied theater thousand years ago in the last millennium, this used to be called naked staging.
Exactly.
In fact, even Shakespeare's day, his plays performed at the Globe Theater outside of London, had very few sets, costumes a little bit.
Not very many props.
The actor who played the King of England might be wearing a crown, but that would be it.
Right.
And then, of course, it was just maybe he had a chair to sit on, whereas others didn't have a throne,
right.
But it was just a regular chair, you know. It didn't, so that was referred to as naked staging, but of course don't think there's going to be naked people here, folks.
No, not at Henry Ford.
So minimalist staging, but that means, as with Shakespeare's plays, you focus on the language,
exactly,
on the words and the emotion of the delivery. And of course, this is seated up close and personal on the Adrae Auditorium stage, and so it's a very, very special experience. This was sometimes referred to as theater in the round, but this is only theater in the half round,
right,
I guess.
Right, right.
So,
but it's very intimate.
Yeah, and as I said, you'll get all the emotion, and the actors say, well, somebody's always saying, too, some of the older people, unfortunately, not being ageist here, but certainly it's true for me, too many years of loud rock concerts,
right.
I want to sit up a little closer so I can hear the speech. You don't have to worry about that. Everybody's up close.
You're right on that apron.
Yeah. And the actors don't have to project way to the back. They just can talk in a relatively normal voice, although clearly, and everybody can catch on to it. So it's a great special experience. As you said, $6 a person.
Yeah.
Fantastic for five great short plays, and all presented by the Henry Ford Community College Theater Department.
Right.
And Dennis is a part of it.
I am.
Are you on stage too? Is there a cameo there?
I'm on stage for a very short period.
You have a
of time.
Line to speak?
I actually did a voiceover. With being in radio, didn't it make sense I would have a voiceover? But as you know, my wife is directing one of these plays, and that, so I've taken part in a lot of. I'm her stage manager, which is almost humorous. But the reality is that these are all student run. Other than Jerry Jablinski, the technical director of our department here,
he's directing one of them.
And I'll tell you what, I'm in his actually, and it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm sure we'll count on you.
It's a great choice. I know Father's Day weekend, and on top of that, the Arab International Festival, not to mention the Belleville National Strawberry Festival. There's always something to do in Detroit, but I think the play is very unique. It's not going to happen again. Of course, they could maybe plan to come next weekend, but avoid the rush, folks.
Yeah.
If you can get here with your family, 8 o'clock Friday, Saturday, 2 p.m. Sunday, this weekend, next weekend, the one-act play festival at Henry Ford Community College main campus, Adrae Auditorium. For more information, they can call or get tickets reserved if they want.
Sure.
You didn't have it memorized.
Well, no. I mean... Actually, no, this is important because it only seats, since it's on the apron, it only seats 60 people.
Right.
So you'll definitely want to, reservations are recommended, and to do that, you'll call 313-845-9817.
One more time?
313-845-9817, or you can go to hfcctheater.org.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, we're going to start wrapping up the show here today. It is 2 minutes before the top of the hour, and we know that Highway 61, the best in blues, hosted by Joanne Korczynska, is going to start up soon. She has not arrived in the building yet, so we need to keep talking, at least till our podcast cuts off, which is usually about 2 minutes after the hour.
Did you have something specific you were going to go into? Because I was really interested in what you were talking about regarding the in Europe. Well, it started in Europe. But the E. coli.
The E. coli, I think, yes.
Yeah, and I didn't know if you had something.
Quick here. No. It's a good idea. I mean, first of all, don't stop eating fresh vegetables, like from farm markets here in the U.S. For a while, they went crazy, and they started saying, from Germany, they said, don't eat tomatoes from Spain. And so, you know, they lost $10 million in tomato sales for no reason because it wasn't there, and they still don't quite know where it was. Well, the writer for the New York Times, Tom Bittman, I think that he was destined to talk about food because you got to bite into
food.
You read
my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. He's a man that bites, and he writes about food things related. He says, remember that where does E. coli come from? First of all, we have a benign E. coli inside our bodies right now. We have to digest food.
Sure.
Okay. But there's other kind of E. coli, and of course, this most dangerous type is called the S-Tech, which is... that's just the short STEC. The S-Tech E. coli is the bad stuff that is very, very dangerous, very poisonous. But he says if you think it's only a German problem, you're wrong. He said that S-Tech used to migrate to food through direct or indirect contact with the contents of an animal's intestinal tract.
Okay.
Yeah, solid bodily waste.
Sure.
Okay, we can't say anything more than that the radio for FCC reasons, but I think you know what we're referring to. And you say, well, you know, how should that part of the animal's intestines ever come in contact with vegetables? Okay, well, sometimes in some countries used for fertilizer,
sure,
for example. So, but you got to be careful about that. And it's also resulted in part from feeding cattle grain as opposed to their natural grass.
Right.
That's where a lot of healthy food people recommend grass-fed beef, grass-fed bison, because it is not going to have, probably not to any extent, the contamination of E. coli, or the dangerous kind of E. coli, S-Tech, S-T-E-C, as cattle fed from grain. Okay? So range fed cattle means that they're eating the grass that's natural there, or they can be taken and fed grass in a limited area in a barn. A lot of the vendors who have natural grass-fed beef are right out there. At least one guy is there every week at the Dearborn Farm Market.
Oh, no kidding.
Right here in Michigan, he claims it's all natural, no antibiotics that they would put into the grain or anything else. And you say, well, if there's not antibiotics in there, it's going to be dangerous. No, folks. The way things are going today is